Hey, welcome to the Morning Mic Check. I'm Pat Brown here with Mike Metzger. Mike and I have known each other for a while now. I first met him around 2010, and he's become one of the key mentors in my life. Over the years, we've had countless conversations, and in almost every one, I've walked away having discovered something new. Mike has this unique ability where he can reframe a conversation, and you begin to discover a deeper reality around you. It's a bit like Alice tumbling down the rabbit hole. I'm releasing these conversations as an invitation to follow me as I go down that rabbit hole. All right, well, here we are. Good morning, Mike. How are you doing?
Good morning. I'm well.
Excellent, excellent. This morning, we're going to continue a little bit on where we were going last week. So we'll be talking about roundtables, and as listeners will eventually see, you know, Dominion's going to flow into that. And as with everything, essentially, that we get to, Dominion seems to sort of peek in through there. But I'd like to start off kind of revisiting why we're talking about this. And I had someone ask a good question, which I think fits into this and fits into where Dominion kind of plays. But his question was around, specifically, if we think of the great commandment to love God and neighbor, what does Dominion have to do with that? So just as a quick little primer for us here, why do we spend so much talking about Dominion? I think maybe that's a good question to dive in there. So do you want to take that one?
No, why don't you take it this time, and we'll go from there.
No, please, please.
please. This is like two guys. That's what happens when you play co-ed volleyball. You both go, oh, no, you take it. Boom, ball hits the sand, and you look at each other. Oh, geez.
Too close.
Well, love in its simplest sense is giving and receiving, but giving requires a receptivity. And so a lot of people are not prepared to receive. And so if you overplay dominion, that is love doesn't force itself on someone, is another way to put it. You have to remember there's a little pithy saying, not even a saying, recorded of the life of Christ, I believe it's in Luke, that Jesus could not do many miracles there. Mm. And you go, well, that's funny, I thought he was omnipotent. Well, he is omnipotent, but he's also love. He doesn't choose to love. He is the embodiment of love, and love does not force itself on someone. So what that has to do with dominion is God has given you some dominion. Everybody has some dominion. You have dominion over your body. You have a degree of dominion, rather. You have dominion, perhaps, to some degree, to work. And loving people is exercising that dominion, but exercising it where you don't have it is not love. It's presumption.
That's great. I think that's well said, simple enough. So this idea of ordering, sort of understanding the degrees of dominion, and, you know, as we talk, when two people come together, there's always that exchange. There's some level of dominion you automatically have with someone. And like you said, it's important to recognize that, because that allows you to love better. It's also a big piece to that is sort of earning dominion with that person and helping them begin to discover not just dominion, but love, life, whatever that looks like. As we are to be disciples of Christ, we are to also lead others in figuring out what that means to exercise dominion. So I think the roundtable's a fun thing to think through, because it sort of puts down to words, oversimplifies to some extent, yes, but it also just is a nice little framework to talk through. So just to revisit that, when I'm talking roundtable, I'm talking about this insider, outsider, left brain, right brain. If you picture a clock, and you start on the right side of that clock, you have Merlin and the court jester, on kind of the external voices, the outside voices. Merlin being wisdom, court jester Dagonet being the crap detector, and being able to call out things seen that are not visible to the insiders on the left side. Left side being, you know, the king and the knights. So you have that full round table, but the king and the knights are typically insiders. They're more of the narrow view. The king being sort of the decision maker, right? The one who decides where everyone's going, and the knights being sort of the doers, the executors, the people who actually go out and get things done. And if we look at organizations, you can apply that or understand organizationally what those pieces are. You could think of maybe a CEO at a high level as the king, you know, the executive level underneath that as the knights. And often we talked about there, unfortunately, businesses often don't have the right side. Many are simply left-brained businesses. You can also take that to a team level if you're not a CEO and you can't resonate with that. You know, you may be on a team within an organization. So you may be actually that knight, and maybe you have a team lead who's kind of the king in your life. But that idea that we can sort of zoom in and zoom out and understand what my part in the round table is, I think it's really fascinating to talk through where does Dominion fit into each of those. So a great example would be like with a court jester, someone who's an outside voice, someone who is sort of that crap detector, someone who calls out things that people don't necessarily want to call out. Maybe you're gifted in that and seeing what's unseen, but if you haven't established dominion, particularly with whoever that king is, you're not going to have very much success as a court jester. Is that right?
Yeah, that's well said.
So I'd be curious. A couple situations come to mind. First and foremost, I think very simply is, what happens if I come into a situation, I'm put in a supervisor position where I am now really sort of formally the king of maybe it's a team, maybe it's a department, whatever that is. Formally, I'm told I'm in charge. I'm over this. What happens then? I've been given dominion, but where are the gaps there? Obviously, I may not actually have dominion with the knights on that team, so to speak. So what's important for me if I've been given a formal position, quote unquote, as a king, what's important for me to understand when it comes to dominion?
Well, there you go. I think you just said it. It's position does not necessarily denote dominion. And so you have to discover what degree or what level of dominion do you actually have. So most, one of the great failures in a business is once you're given a supervisory position, you typically assume you have more dominion than you actually do have. So that might be played out in terms of people triangulate outside the meeting, people don't give you proper respect, they don't really pay attention in the meeting, some are envious of your position, all those things. There could be 100 things going on that you really don't have the dominion that you think you have. And that's fine if the ship's going in the right direction and everyone's going well and you're very profitable. But when you hit a speed bump or when you hit a difficulty, you'll discover, we really didn't have organizational alignment here. We did on a piece of paper that was called an org chart, but didn't have the dominion I thought I had. By the way, great companies discover this. They do this as a routine, is what's called exit interviews. And an exit interview is when you discover what you really had in terms of dominion. The other thing to do, if a supervisor would be wise to do, is before you start a project, once you've got it all laid out, have everyone write a pre-mortem. Ever heard of a pre-mortem?
I have, but I'm sure many have not.
Yeah, so what's a post-mortem?
Sort of a recap after the fact. Something went wrong. We're trying to figure out what went wrong.
Yeah, a postmortem is an autopsy, and so it says here's what killed this person. Here's why they died. A premortem is once you got it all laid out, you then write a story of 5 years out why this project in which you're a supervisor, why it failed. Two things in this. I was just with, there's an individual I coach in a certain industry, and I was with this person this week, and we remembered the pre-mortem that we wrote some 7-8 years ago in the company where this person works, because the project never materialized and never had the kind of impact that was hoped for. And I took this person back to the pre-mortem because of the 10 or 12 people that wrote it. This person's pre-mortem, this person actually shed tears when this person began to read it, because it was so real. It was so painful to watch this project die. Everybody else's was generalized, vague. But what you're looking for in a pre-mortem is you're looking for pain points. And what they do is they alert your project team to things that you're that will take this down if you don't address them. And typically what will come out is didn't execute, didn't follow through, didn't respect the leader. And you'll begin to then see, like, if they don't execute, that you don't have the degree of dominion at this point right now that you might assume you have, because everyone salutes and says, yes, sir, we're getting after it, Pat. And in fact, they're going to be not quite as enthusiastic about this as you thought they were. So those are different things you can do, but it is very typical in the left brain, any of us, because again, these are biases. We use both halves, both hemispheres. But if you bias the left hemisphere, which most people unwittingly and unknowingly do, the left hemisphere is the only one that's predictive. The right hemisphere doesn't know what's going to happen the next second. It's receptive. So it doesn't know that there could be all of a sudden a tree falls outside. It's not going to predict, here's what's going to happen a minute from now. But the left brain is predictive, and both are necessary. What I like about a round table is the symmetry there is that everyone is equidistant from the center. So no one is better than the other. No one individual is better than the other. But because the left hemisphere, the insider is predictive, it's very easy then to become presumptuous. And then the presumption is, okay, here's our sales forecast. Here's what we're going to do here. Here's what we're going to do this. This is what's going to happen. And those are absolutely necessary. But, you know, James had a bit of warning when, remember the person who said, now we're going to go to such and such a city and open a business and make such and such a profit. And the writer, James, said, the only thing you forgot is, if the Lord wills. Because you don't know the future. And the power of having an ambidextrous organization is it's a wise sage and a court jester have walked these trails before. And when they hear something, they go, I'd be careful here, or look what you just missed. The left hemisphere operating on its own, if it has assumed too much authority or dominion, will go, yeah, whatever, we don't have time for that. I call the insider, it's the gum smacking, you know, okay, good, great, yeah, well, that ain't gonna happen here. The right, if it's given proper dominion, is paid attention to. And those organizations are rare. They're few and far between.
Well, I think sometimes those people are rare as well, who maybe don't have that crap detector, don't have the wise sage to help them see if maybe they are in a position where they are the king, right? And they're not aware they don't have dominion. Or maybe, like even I did earlier, they're conflating position with dominion and in a false way, saying, well, I have formal dominion, right? I've been given dominion by my superiors, but that's sort of a blind approach to dominion. It's not actually having dominion.
Yeah, that's a really good point. So on the super macro level, for example, in our last presidential election, He saw that the those who were whose candidate didn't win, many of them said that of our current president, he's not my president, which is a very left brain narrow focus. Well, as a matter of fact, he is. now, I am in no way, I'm not advocating for one or the other. That's not the point. The point is that Dominion is not, if you were the president, you'd say, I don't have dominion with them. I have dominion by the strong arm of the law, but that's kind of the dominion of last resort. But in terms of influencing how people view what would be good and beneficial and helpful, doesn't have dominion at all. And so it's easy for positional to confuse positional with actual, and the actual dominion is best discovered by asking questions. In fact, Pat, let's take it down from the 35,000. Let's take it all the way down to you and me and just individuals you know. I would wager that most people I know, let's just talk about the faith community. Most believers I know don't have a personal round table.
Yeah, I would agree.
And the easiest way to think about this is that you're an insider inside your own life. It's just the way it goes. And
some of us may be outsiders. I don't know.
Of course, you could have an out-of-body experience, and God might very well do that to see yourself in a different light. I get all that. But if you don't, this is why before the Enlightenment, particularly, it was understood that you discover truth by having a reliable guide, someone who's walked this path before, spiritual director, if you want to call it. And you also, there's also this understanding, and William Wilberforce cites it in a letter that he wrote to his daughter Elizabeth when she was 13 years old, way back in 1815. And he said, "I hope at this age, Elizabeth, you have accustomed yourself to the faithful reproofs of a friend." Reproofs meaning, I hope you've accustomed yourself. It's your habit to get feedback from the prophetic voice, the crap detector voice. Then he cites Jeremiah's warning in the Babylonian exile about the conscience is deceitful and desperately wicked. Who can understand it? His point is the easiest person to dupe is you, Elizabeth. You are the easiest person for you to dupe, to con, to kid. And if you don't have that outside voice, I find it fascinating. 13 years old, and he is saying, I hope it's habit. And he was saying in one of the most tender ways he could to his daughter. I've given the copies of this portion of this letter to many friends, that this was just understood before the Enlightenment. The reason I say the Enlightenment is in a paper that C.S. Lewis wrote that most people aren't that familiar with. Basically says the Enlightenment, it elevated authority to the individuals. In other words, I'm self-conscious of everything I'm thinking. I'm on top of my game. Therefore, second reason, my reasoning powers are pretty darn good. Third, I interpret my experience then accurately. So it works out to be authority, reason, and experience. And what Lewis understood was, first of all, you're probably a stranger to yourself. You shouldn't be the authority on your life. You're the insider. You ought to have outside voices actually telling you who you are. Second, we're predictably irrational now, is what all the findings are showing in neuroscience. So we're only aware of about 5% of our behaviors. We're predictably irrational. So therefore, we continually misinterpret the kind of influence and dominion we have. We really are strangers to ourselves. And so with the Enlightenment, When people say, oh, enlightenment, schlightenment, what are you talking about? It's most evident in the fact that the average Christian I know, A, doesn't have a spiritual guide or director. I'm not talking about hearing your pastor preach and taking notes. That's like my freshman year in college when I sat in a hall with 300 students and took notes and had my biology, intro to biology. That prof was not my mentor. That prof was not my guide. It's probably a teaching assistant now that I think about it. And second, even more importantly, few people have a crap detector, or in the mafia called a consigliere, or someone that can cut it straight with you without having to preface, without having to be cautious and say, hey, I don't want to offend you. Hey, I don't want to invade your space. Hey, I don't want to. When anybody feels hesitant to approach you on anything, what you are, the signal you have sent to them is beware. Go ahead, step into this field and tackle the subject, but it's loaded with landmines. And if you step on one and blow your foot off, that's your problem.
I think that's super. A lot of people are going to hear that and either pass right by it or try to pretend it doesn't actually have to do anything with them. But yeah, I think that's really just came out in a conversation I was having last night. Just this missing piece of being able to be confronted. And I think often it's partly because you see a lot of over confrontation today in the world around us. So we're naturally a little bit more resistant, but to be able to have wise people in your life call things out is really powerful. I also think it's interesting, Mike, we've talked often about frustration. Frustration is dominion thwarted, meaning if there's a gap between what you want to influence or control and what you actually can influence or control, you tend to get frustrated. That's just sort of the result.
Yeah.
I think it's interesting to think if I am a king and I'm frustrated, maybe it's at work, maybe it's at even home, the dynamic of relationships there, I tend to be a, you know, king at times. In that frustration, I think it exposes a gap in dominion, which if I am at work and I'm getting frustrated with my team and I'm thinking, gosh, why won't they listen to me? The problem's possibly not with your team. The problem's likely I haven't gained their dominion. Now, that said, if we're going to look at the perspective of maybe, you know, I'm actually a knight. So I go to work. I don't really have a say in many things. I'm not really a king. I'm definitely not an outsider. I'm an inside voice, and I am getting frustrated because I'm not being listened to. I think the harsh reality, particularly if I'm a believer in that situation, is embracing the fact that I'm not to be listened to right now. I don't have authority. I don't have dominion. I have not earned enough to actually have a say. A lot of people don't like that approach, particularly my age. We think we deserve that say, but I love the necessity of humility in that. So if I'm getting frustrated at work because no one listens to me, in the same vein, I may actually be the problem there, right?
That's right. That's right.
So how do you reconcile that if, let's say I'm maybe not fresh out of college, a year or two out of college, I'm starting my job, I am frustrated because I see all these problems and I'm trying to speak to them, but no one's listening to me. I'm curious what your advice would be there.
You can't figure out the problem. This reminds me, I've had a couple of friends who left the pastorate and they went into business. And I've seen this happen more than once. Several darn near got fired in their first year. I was a pastor for 8 years, listeners, so I'm not railing against any profession. But more often than not, especially in independent-type churches or in Protestant churches, the pastor pretty much, you know, runs the show. And well, that's put in a pejorative way, but is in a place that they don't have to really have a sounding board. They don't have to have a round table. What draws me to older traditions is you have a hierarchy which also vets things like even sermons. So these young men, when they would start in with these businesses and begin to say, well, that's not the way it ought to be. I ought to do this and that. And people that have been in the business for 20 years look at them like, well, who the hell are you? And so I think that you said it well, that there's such a thing as industriousness that earns you cultural capital. And industriousness is just put your hand to what God has you and work hard at it. And actually show that you're worth listening to. But just the fact of whatever you did before, or wherever you went to school, or whatever you feel you bring to the table, that is a thoroughly inside view of yourself and your splendiferous gifts that you just want to spill out on everyone and bless their little you-know-whats. And that's just not the way it works. I remember my father telling me, he said, 5 years out of college, it doesn't really matter where you went to college. You got to have proven something in those first 5 years if you think you're actually going to go somewhere. And so to your point is, yeah, you're only there a year or two, and you're put in a position and you're given a task to do. I would say do it better than anybody else in that position.
Yeah, no, I would agree. And particularly if you have sort of a desire to be in a leadership role or to get there, a huge piece that I've seen as I've grown both in my career, but also in my faith and in life in general, the ability to lead people is incredibly important. And so if I'm a low man on the totem pole, if I'm just this knight who can execute on things and I want to be a leader and all I'm doing is getting frustrated because other people won't listen to me, you simply will never be that leader. You must learn how to lead others. And a huge piece to that is gaining dominion with others. And it was probably about 5 years ago now where you and I were talking through a lot of this, and I just realized, wow, okay, so at my company for the next likely 3 years, I'm going to have to put my head down and work and work really well and learn to ask really good questions. And that's about all I can do. Any frustration I experienced between now and then, I have to recognize that's a problem with me. I have false expectations for where I'm going with this company in the near term. I need to work well. I need to work hard. I need to ask good questions. And, at the same time,
that's right.
Having a good crap detector in my life and whatnot. So I think that's both a word of encouragement, but also a word of caution, particularly as you said. If I think of the guys in full-time ministry right now, the Young Life, the that type of camp, parachurch, that maybe after college they went into that and now they're there. And now they're at a company, and they just, in a lot of situations, had all this influence with teens, and now they're going to a company where they're essentially a nobody. I've seen it be very frustrating because they feel like they have little influence. And the harsh reality is it's because they don't. They're on a path where they're gaining that.
Yeah, it'd be just like if Johns Hopkins Applied Physics Lab hired me tomorrow. I know, suspend judgment there. I mean, but the fact is, I'd walk in, I have no idea what they're doing. I would have zero, other than I slightly raise the temperature of the room by my body heat. But otherwise, yes, you have to have, we're just, this is more a problem, by the way, with a leader, because a leader is going to tend to think when they walk in to a room, influence. It's going on in the subconscious. You're not, I mean, it's called work in the room, or you sort of look around and see who's here, and you, who do I remember? Or leaders, I did a strategic planning session for a group this past weekend, and you don't even think about it. You just come in, you meet someone, and I subconsciously start saying their name 3, 4, 5 times just because I want to remember their name. And,
yep.
And you just kind of do that stuff. And, you know, most people don't do that. But to your point, it is earned. And that's why, you know, a lot of times, you know, for example, when the Judeans are grabbed by the nape of the neck by God and drug into Babylon, 3 deportations, Nebuchadnezzar selects out the sons of Judah and brings them into his courts to learn the Babylonian language and literature. Have you ever asked yourself, why did he select that group of people, that group of leaders? Why select them?
It's a great question.
Well, you know the answer. I mean, back in Jerusalem, they served in King Jeconiah's court. And so for Nebuchadnezzar, the sons of Judah, I mean, the reason he imported, he kidnapped, if you want to put it, but he had these Judeans come in, they were slave labor. And civilizations were built on slave labor. But not these sons of Judah. This was what's called a value add. And the value adds, they bring value to his administration. So they bring them in. But they'd earned that back in Jerusalem. And so to your point, you're fresh out of college or you're just a few years out, you got to earn your stripes. And you can even do it in college. We sit across the street from a great books curriculum college of about 550 students. And it has many redeeming benefits to a great books, a liberal arts education. But I kid a lot of the students, and I've been a spiritual guide for a number of them over the years. And I said, your path through this town of Annapolis is very small. You go from a certain cool, funky feel coffee shop back to campus, back to the cool, funky feel coffee shop back over to campus. It's just 2 blocks off, and then you walk right by our house. And so one year I said to one of these young men I'm mentoring, I said, why don't you go turn right there on Maryland Avenue and go down to this Irish pub and go to work. And 3 weeks later, he's sitting here in our kitchen. He's slightly depressed. It's a good depression. He says, wow, I didn't know the whole world was out here. And what you find out, it's a world of, there's a whole lot of people and a whole lot of jobs that are basically, this is it. There's a guy who works in the pub over there, and he's probably approaching 50, and that's it. I mean, he's not going to be governor in 4 years. He's not going to be in the House of Representatives. He's not going to be starting a new app business that's going to make him $1 billion. He's not going to be starting a unicorn. You just meet a whole lot of people like this, and you begin to go, wow, this town is populated with these people who are, if you're going to get ahead at all, you're going to have to be industrious. And I've said to him, that's what the school lacks across the street, frankly. It's a great education, but you don't come out with real people who are industrious. And so he did that for a summer, and it was part of, I think it was part of his, he has a personal roundtable. If you want to get back to our point here, I don't think the average believer has a spiritual guide. That's not a discipleship group, as most of them turn out to be. It's not a community group, as most of them turn out to be. It's not a, let's sit around and share little things we see from the Bible. A guide, a mentor from the Greek fable, is someone who had walked this path many, many times before. And so the son was entrusted to a guide to take this young man on that path. You can't take someone further than you've been. So the average believer hasn't been very far because they don't have a guide. And they don't have this, this, for lack of a better word, what Ernest Hemingway called is a requirement for being a first-rate writer, is you have to have a crap detector. The crap detector is not always sharpening a knife, waiting for the moment that they can skewer you Rather, it is the receptive voice in your life that is not, it just simply loves you, but hears you say something and goes, wait, 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 can we talk about that? So the left brain is very predictive, and because it's predictive, it tends to take too much dominion. The right brain is not predictive. It doesn't know what you're going to say. It doesn't know what a group's going to say. It doesn't know what a company's going to say. But it's in the middle of a meeting, perhaps, if you had this on your supervisory level in your department, Pat, that the court jester just kind of raises his hand and says, well, can I ask a question about what we just did there?
Yeah. If you're in that spot and you're super frustrated because you feel like no one is listening to you, I would absolutely encourage, well, zoom in a little bit. And if you're tired of someone else not listening to your voice, who do you have in your life that is your voice that you're not listening to? If you don't have anyone there, don't try to get someone else to do what you are not doing. So,
yeah, here's another way to do it. That's a great idea. You reminded me of, so years ago, well, actually when I was a pastor, I took, it's a big famous church, but set aside that I took their gifts assessment test. And this gifts assessment test back then, this church was famous for a lot of leaders. And I noticed that very few people came out with gifts of like administration. So all I did was take the assessment and flipped it from a first person singular to a third person. And so instead of saying, you know, I like doing this, I like doing that, you hand it to five different people and you say, he is good at this, he likes doing this, he does this. And the results come out wildly different.
Wow. Yeah, I could see that.
And so this church was famous for, you know, this plethora of people who all scored, you know, high on leadership. Well, it's because that was the emphasis of the senior pastor at that time, and that was the supposed culture of the church, and so on and so forth. Yeah, there are, and also, this is where numbers do help us. So here would be another thing you can do. You hand out, and you say, this is going to be anonymous, but I want you to, on a scale of 1 to 10, and you are granted total anonymity, your job is not in peril, score me as a leader. And then you just come up with a whole series of questions, but have them do it on a scale of 1 to 10. Listen attentively, courteous, kind, serve you well, seek you for you to help you grow beyond even my position, things like that. You can come up with 10, 20. You can come up with a number of them. And you say, score me on a scale of 1 to 10. And don't put your name on it. And then fold it and hand it to me. And then you go to another room and have a good cry when you... It is very, very hard for people to be candid with superiors. But you're only superior by position, not by dominion.
Yeah. I think it's good.
That's why exit interviews are helpful, because exit interviews, the gloves are off. Okay, here's why I did blah, blah, blah. And they say, you're full of, go ahead.
No, yeah, that's right on. You know, it's funny thinking about that, even, again, seeing dominion everywhere. Even with that interplay, if you are handing someone a survey and say, you know, gauge me on being a leader. If these are with people who you oversee, and you haven't actually earned dominion with them yet, that may totally backfire. Not because they won't answer necessarily honestly, but because in asking them for that, if you haven't set up dominion with them already, if you haven't earned that, then in a way you are trying to exercise dominion by getting them to do this thing for you, for your benefit. That's, you know, that's the way it can be perceived. And that may totally backfire. And so, again, the importance of understanding dominion when it comes to interacting with people.
Good. So there's three questions you put at the end of it. That's really good, Pat. Here's the first question. To what degree are you comfortable doing this exercise? 10, you'd be absolutely comfortable, candid. One. Second question. Were you candid with me? Scale 1 to 10. 10, 100%, 1, you know, 0. Third, what question do you wish I would have asked you? Leave it blank.
Yeah, that's good. Did you just come up with that off the top of your head?
Yeah, that's what it is. Actually, it came out of my ears, but.
That's good. I mean, that really, yeah, those three are very impactful. That's good.
I have found that. I get excited. I have found, well, let me put it this way. I mean, Kathy and I have been married for 38 years, and part of the reason why we love each other and have such a wonderful friendship is you really have to burrow into each other's lives. And we're just, it grieves us how few couples we know do this. We have to, you just have to talk at deeper and deeper levels about, we just mask who we are out of fear of being accepted, or, I mean, this is deep stuff. And if you don't do this with your friends, and you don't even do this with your spouse, then you're probably not going to do it in your business. Because human nature is human nature is human nature. This doesn't change when you walk into a business setting. And you know, Kathy and I have been through deep waters, and what you end up with is, well, put another way, we can tell pretty early on with any couples that there are whole pastures and fields and areas that they can't walk into because they have landmines and they can't see them. You don't want to get your foot blown off. So it could be, I hear him say, Mike, we can't go there. Or, you know, I'll be prefaced by one spouse saying, we get together, by the way, don't go there. That's a terrible marriage. It's a very grievous marriage. But that's what you get in businesses too. You don't go there. I worked under a man, a president of a company years ago, and you know, the number of people who it was a classic. It was right out of this same as I just saw at a repeat of The Office recently. I mean, nobody left the office until he left. And so, you know, people fiddling around on their computers, playing solitaire, screen hidden, just waiting for him to leave the building. But that man did not ask the kind of questions you're asking. And he didn't have a crap detector, and he didn't have a guide, but he was wealthy, and he had a Zooming company at that time. And people wanted to get on that, they wanted to ride that jet. Well, strap in. And they really found out strapped in means more than they imagined.
Well, we've talked a lot about the left side. I think rightfully so. It's the reality is it's not, call me out on this, Mike, as always, but I suspect to think that I am maybe the court jester or Merlin role, particularly if I'm in my, you know, mid to late 20s, early 30s, it's probably unlikely I'm actually in that role. Is that accurate?
Yeah. Why is that?
Well, in a lot of ways, it's because I simply don't have enough experience in life to be able to actually speak wisely about a lot of things.
Sure.
So
that's it.
So I think it's worth talking through. If you think maybe you're that outside voice for someone and you're frustrated people aren't listening to you, again, dominion thwarted, you're trying to control something that you can't control, I would guess the first problem is you likely may be exercising the wrong role. Would you agree?
Or you have an accrued capital.
Yeah,
another way to put it, Pat, is even at your tender age, someone could be hanging out, like playing ball with you or something, and saying, "Hey, man, could you help me get in shape like you are?" And for listeners, Pat is ripped now, but Pat is strong. And there's times I give him a hug. I go, "Geez, oh, pizza, man, this guy's got muscles I haven't." We'll see what you now. Let me ask you a question. Are all those things, are those all implants? Did you have surgery?
I did not.
Because I've actually heard of men getting calf
It's a
muscle
thing.
in.
Yeah, it's a thing.
Wow. So you earned it by industriousness.
Sure.
So that's, you weren't Tony Mandrich. It wasn't, you weren't, you didn't get it by, the meds. You did it, you were industrious. And so, in the same way, but you're right, you couldn't become a rabbi till you were 30. Generally, you generally can't become a priest until you're 30. Jesus didn't start his public ministry until he was 30. There's a lot of benefit to recognizing, I probably can't be a guide. Until you're probably at least 30. It's just, again, you can't take people further than you've been. And so when you don't, you never walk the path, and where it's just, it's so, you're so familiar with it that you don't even think about it. And you really can't guide anybody because you're looking around just as much as they are, saying, "Now, where are we going? How's this going to work out? What are we doing?" So they're not going to give you much dominion because they're going to just sense you haven't been there. It's something that people ooze. And so it's difficult. You come into any organization, it's said within 6 months, you are now habituated. You are an insider. You're walking on the paths that are the paths of this company. And I know where you work, and I know the path you take if you have lunch over in the lunchroom. And within 6 months, you weren't even thinking about that path. But the first time you took it, you were alert to all sorts of things. Your right brain was really amped up because it was all new.
Right.
Curb here, railroad tracks, parking lot, this, I got it, okay, where do you go? Where, and the, oh, over here, you swipe your card, got it, got, oh, salad bar, this, that, oh, cool, oh, look at the big, oh, yeah, look at that, wow. 6 months later, I'm having lunch with you there, and you hardly notice a thing about it. I'm the one going, "Oh, look at that. That's cool. This is not our, hey, Pat, where do you go?" And you were actually a guide, if you remember the first time we had lunch there. You say, "Yeah, over here, Mike, is where I got this and this and this."
Yeah, it's a good point. It's a good point. By the time you start to have those sort of vision of things, of how things maybe rightfully ought to be, and your organization does not align with that, well, you may actually be an insider and not realize it. And so you may have already been habituated in that instance, but you also may not understand the underlying complexities of things. I began to ask myself the question, okay, well, but what do I not see right now? Because to me, it's pretty clear. Maybe this person could be doing their job better, or we wouldn't have this problem as a company if this person just did this thing. And slowly, I started to realize, well, there's actually a lot going on that I just don't see, and I don't know. And so the reason, if I voice those things, the reason I'm not taken seriously is because it's a pretty ignorant viewpoint. It's just that simple. I'm by circumstance, I'm ignorant. I don't have enough insight into what's actually going on.
Yeah, that is really well said. It's said that the left hemisphere again is very important for getting things done and producing, but it does tend to reduce complexity to simplicity to get things done. And so if it just so happens that the first time you go play golf, you're hitting 300-yard drive straight down the middle, and you just go, "Well, this is a pretty simple game." That's called dumb luck. But it's simple for you, but you don't understand the complexities that are involved, and the evidence of which will be if the next thing you know, you're like me and you're slicing everything off to the right, and you cannot figure out what's going wrong here. So a lot of people just intuitively start something and it goes well, it's like Gerald Nachman, the cultural historian, said, "Nothing fails like success." So the most successful company is the one that complexity. Nah, we got the supply chain figured out. We got this and this and this. We're rocking and rolling, and you just become aware of unaware of what are the potential negative side effects that are going to come up and bite you in the rear. And that's again where if you have a complete round table, they're not smarter, they're not better, they're not. But the outsider just tends to go, "Well, what about this though? What about why?" I wrote a piece on this couple, in last spring that's what the Tampa Bay Rays, they hired a kid out of Canada just because he's part of their staff to say, "Well, why? Why would you do? Why would you start a starting pitcher? Why not a middle reliever? Why do this? Why do that?" And Tampa Bay, with one of the lowest payrolls, made the playoffs last year. Better performance by having a round table.
Pretty cool. It's pretty cool to see that play out. So at the end of the day, why does it all matter? Maybe help me understand what the heck does a round table have to do with loving my neighbor? Give me that maybe one more time.
Well, a personal round table again is we're made in the image of the triune God, Father, Son, Spirit, which is best depicted as a circle. Equidistant, but a circle is infinite, has no beginning and end. So historically, a sphere or a circle, a round table is a circle. So we made in the image of God function best inside a circle that includes others who are equals. And so that's the simplest reason is I think we talked about last time. It's even why I think God created our brains to be circular, so to say, and two hemispheres. I mean, a left hemisphere person would say, "Well, that's not very efficient. Should have just made one hemisphere. I mean, let's get the thing done." And it's the right hemisphere that goes, well, maybe, but there's more data coming in. Let's hold on here." So, in the simplest sense, we're made in the image of the triune God, who is depicted as a sphere. And a round table is a sphere and a circle. And it best depicts how anyone, well, the human race flourishes. That's what it best depicts, because that circle of love, Father, Son, Spirit, is not only depicts the enjoyment of one another, but it also depicts the second aspect of love. Love is the desire to expand the circle. So love is the enjoyment of the circle and the desire to expand the circle. And that's humanity designed by God, for God to marry, expanding the circle of love. That's the reason we exist. God wants to marry us. Your creator is your husband. Isaiah 54, 5. You are my betrothed, married. And so a round table in its simplest sense, Pat, depicts how we flourish as human beings, made in the image of God. And it's how any organization, a church, a business, a sportswear company, an insurance company, any business flourishes.